This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2022, held at Faith Builders on August 2 through 5.
Good morning. It is good to see everybody here. And I love to hear the little chatter between people as we wait for class. The longer the week goes, the more that happens, which is great. It's good to see everybody here today. I'm very excited about our topic on trauma and what we can learn. For a little introduction to myself, I taught school for 11 years, and my last 4 years of teaching were in Honduras. Maybe some of you have heard of the Good Shepherd Children's Home. I taught at the school right there by the children's home. So my first year there, I had third grade, and the next year I had fourth grade plus a special needs student. And then I went on to tutoring, tutored for a couple years. Now, two of these students are in the youth group with me now. So it's been 6 years since I taught. In the last 6 years, I have a secretary job that I can do remotely, and I work part-time and help my family part-time. So I've been able to have a variety of experiences over the last 6 years. I've really enjoyed it. Part of the year I'm in Honduras. I live with my sister Carol, top left. That's her with her family. She's under the children's home, one of the moms from there. And I like to come home, spend time with mom, get to work in the office. The office is close by where mom lives sometimes. So we just got done canning about 275 quarts of green beans, if that gives you an idea what I do at home. That's not just for us, it's also for my brother's family. So yeah, it's been a blessing. I've been able to help with some new babies, and it's been fun to be able to be freer to help my family. Two of my brothers are involved in mission work in New York City, so I've also had the privilege to spend time up there over the last several years. I also taught Down syndrome students in Myerstown, PA before I taught in Honduras. So that's another facet of special education. That's not what we're talking about today, but those were enjoyable years as well. Today we're going to be talking about the children who look perfectly normal, but they're a puzzle because they have learning difficulties. And it's just kind of hard to figure out why, because they seem so normal in so many areas. I would say my most thorough introduction to trauma children came from living with my sister and her children. When you live with them, you see it up close. And even though I'm not teaching, my burden has moved to the trauma youth and people who come to church. I really enjoy relationships with the young people, some of the girls from church there in Honduras. So I give a lot of credit to this set of DVDs. This was very helpful for the information I'm sharing today. I really enjoy this study on the brain, how the brain functions, the different parts of the brain, and I'm just going to give you a quick overview of that today. So hopefully it doesn't sound too much like a science class. You can order these DVDs, and you can also rent them, and I have the information on your handout if you're interested in this resource. One thing I think about when I start teaching, it's easy to look at our mistakes, or it's easy to just wish we could know everything. But I'm just amazed at God's grace and how he uses us as humans and keeps teaching us little by little, gives us experiences. And it's just exciting to keep learning. And I just encourage you all to look forward and think about your students this coming year. And hopefully you can get some tips that help with this coming year. If you have questions throughout the class, feel free to ask questions anytime. So, trauma, what has it done to my students' brain? First of all, let's think of some examples of what could be considered trauma in a child's early life. And the first one is prenatal harm. Some of you mentioned a mom that was on drugs before the baby was born. 80% of adopted children were exposed to alcohol or drugs before they were born. Alcohol passes from the mother's blood to the child's blood and damages brain cells. So a child harmed by alcohol looks perfectly normal, but has a learning disorder in a certain area. Fetal alcohol changes thinking patterns in the brain. So one of the children from the children's home down there worked for the house parent. She helped around the place, and it's just interesting when she heard directions, what she heard. So one day, the house parent was giving her instructions for her work that day, and she was supposed to go out in the backyard. And when you're standing at the gate, you're going to see a row of bushes on the left-hand side. There's a palm tree at the end. But the second to last one is a pricker bush. So get the snippers and cut off that long shoot that's growing over the fence. The girl came back to the house parent later and said, "There's no way I can cut that thing down." And the house parent's like, "Why?" She's like, "Well, it's just big. It's a palm tree." So what the house parent used for a landmark is what she remembered. And she didn't think through that the house parent wouldn't ask her to cut down a palm tree. So there's things like that to work with. It changes thinking patterns in their brain. So perhaps the mother took drugs or drank alcohol, or perhaps the mother suffered from malnutrition. One of my students had a biological mother who lived on the streets, and I have to wonder, does that affect her health today? She struggles physically as a teenager. Sometimes there's some weaknesses there. A mother under stress. So if the unborn baby could talk, what would they say? They would probably say, "Mom, you're stressing me out." When we are under stress, our body produces a stress hormone, cortisol. And cortisol crosses the placenta and loads the baby's stress system with cortisol. This I find interesting, but excited stress has the same negative effect on brain chemistry that traumatic stress does. So if the mother is very excited, or if she is depressed, these stresses both produce cortisol and negatively affect the baby's brain chemistry. An example of stress chemicals interrupting a baby's brain cell development would be the cleft lip. The Karen Purvis, the one who gave the workshops on these DVDs, said that normally a child's lip closes in the 7th or 8th week of pregnancy. She told the story of a child who was born with a lip that was not closed, or we call it the cleft lip. The 7th or 8th week of pregnancy is when the mom found out she was pregnant, and she was fighting with her boyfriend and trying to decide what she was going to do with this baby, whether she would keep the baby, whether she would give it up. That's an example of how stress can interrupt a baby's development. Another one of my students, his mom was fleeing in a war when she was pregnant with him, and his dad was physically abusive to the mom. Beat up his birth mom. He's a child that deals with extreme fears in his life. So that means that the baby adopted straight from the hospital has likely experienced trauma. These are three that can happen before birth. Sometimes it's a difficult birth. It could be that the birth was obviously difficult, or maybe the baby was deprived of oxygen for a short time during birth. Medical trauma, early hospitalization. And although it's needed to save lives, we're so thankful for hospitals. But to a young child, this is trauma. When they're in the NICU, isolated, in their little hospital bed, they don't understand that their life is being saved. To them, this is trauma. And abuse of any kind, and this is the one you expected to hear. The brain symmetry is different in a child who has been abused. One side of the brain becomes more active than the other, and this sets them up for learning difficulties. Neglect or inconsistent care. So which do you think is worse, the trauma from neglect or the trauma from abuse? The message of abuse is, "I don't like you." The message of neglect is, "You don't exist." That's right. So many times children who were only neglected suffer more damage than the child who was abused. Natural disasters, man-made trauma, could be a fire, flood, car accident, medical emergency where a 911 needed to be called, and there's other less obvious factors as well. One traumatic experience is enough to change a child's brain development. And even though we don't always know what happened in an adopted child's early life, It is safe to assume that most of them have experienced some type of trauma. And obviously it's going to affect some more than others. Some it's harder for them to cope and work through. And some really struggle, need extra support. Biological children are not exempt. Things happen that are outside loving parents' control as well. I have a little nephew who really struggled. He could be the sweetest little boy, and he'd be a terror. He wondered where the things came from that were coming out of his mouth, and his parents went for some extra help for him. And the one who evaluated him was asking questions about his life. Well, when he was a little boy toddling around, just learning to walk, he was holding a ruler in his hand, and he fell and the ruler jammed back into his mouth. So like he needed a major surgery. He needed stitches way back in his mouth. Another time he had fallen and broken his leg. They took him to the hospital, to the doctor. There was some for mix up, and he ended up with a broken leg that didn't get attention right away. Like he had that broken leg. I think they needed to take him back in, and they're like, something is wrong with this boy's leg. Like he's not moving it, he's not using it. So sometimes it's things like that that cause a child to struggle. So we're going to go into basic understanding of the brain. We're going to divide it into two parts, the downstairs brain and the upstairs brain. So the lower part and the upper part. A child who has experienced trauma may get stuck in the downstairs part of the brain. So think about the things we're going to talk about in the downstairs part of the brain. This is what the trauma children knows. And then we'll talk about the upper part, which is the part that they're not accessing efficiently. So the downstairs part of the brain, we start with the brain stem. And that's the lowest region of the brain. And this is developed by genetics, fully functional at birth. It's responsible for survival function. It allows the child to breathe, eat, sleep, and hear. It's also responsible for reactions. Fight, flight, freeze, the response when a child is scared, and it controls the basic emotions like love and hate, sadness, and fear. Next, we have the thalamus, and this is located right above the brainstem. It's the highway that directs the sensory information to the upper parts of the brain for processing. So sensory information is anything that comes to you through your senses, what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you feel. This part of the brain has to do with the senses. If this part of the brain is damaged, it cannot process all the sensory information it receives. A child becomes confused. This gets labeled as sensory processing disorder. The hippocampus is responsible for remembering the locations of objects or people. This is what helps you know where things are located. And it is responsible for emotional responses. And the amygdala is the fear center. This is a tiny but mighty mass of neurons, and it is critical how we make sense out of fear. It's the reason we are afraid of things outside of our control. Now, another example from Karen Purvis's DVDs. She talked about how studies have been performed where they use deep lesioning, which is simply insert a thin wire into the brain to remove or terminate a part of the brain. And they did this to remove the amygdala of rats. So how do you think removing the amygdala of rats affected them? They say after the amygdala was removed, they had no fear of anything, not even cats. The removal of the amygdala had taken away the rat's memory of fear. So the amygdala is what allows us to feel fear. Now, do you know any children whose amygdala is working overtime? They struggle with unreasonable fears, and to them it's real. They're serious. So I had one little boy that just had a really hard time studying in school. Just like, what? Here, his dad was away that day, and it wasn't even anything big. It was just normal. He was away that day, and the boy was really scared that his dad was going to get killed. That was a real fear to him, and it kept him from studying. Maybe it's the fear that one of their younger siblings is going to fall off the homemade swing and kill themselves. And this is real. They are serious. They are scared. Then we have the upper part of the brain. And remember that the trauma child may be stuck in the lower part. So they have the survival functions. They have that ability to fear. They have those kind of responses. The part we're talking about next is the part that they cannot efficiently access. So the upper part is a more sophisticated part. It includes the cortex, and it takes a long time to develop. It develops throughout our lives. And this is what allows us to regulate our emotions, calm ourselves down, understand ourselves and other people. I'm sure you've noticed that one if you've worked with trauma children. It allows us to be flexible, to make good choices, and it allows for complex thought, reasoning, emotional processing, speech, the ability to regulate our behavior. So the cerebral cortex is a folded surface that covers our brain, and that's made of tightly packed neurons called brain cells. Two hemispheres, and in a perfect world, both function well and work together. And this is the part that's responsible for higher thought processes, including speech and decision making. Then we have the four lobes. We have the frontal, parietal, temporal, and occipital, which are responsible for different types of sensory information. So the occipital lobe is for vision. Your brain processes what you see. Parietal lobe processes sensory information that has to do with taste, touch, temperature. And these parts of our brain are fast. They need to process information super fast. Temporal lobe is for hearing. And this lobe is special because it makes sense of all the different sounds and pitches being transmitted from the ears to the temporal lobe of our brain. And this is what helps us to be able to comprehend meaningful speech. So what happens if a child's temporal lobe is not functioning well? As an exercise, when I was working with one of my special needs students, I had her repeat a sentence right after me. So the sentence I said to her was, "Jake and Harry went to town on Tuesday and bought a gift for Grandma." My student said, right after me, "Jake and John went to town on Thursday and bought a gift for Mom." Is it any wonder? She needed lots of hands-on teaching. Do you notice how many pieces of information she got incorrect in the second sentence? Three. So it makes it a challenge if the child is not able to process what they're hearing, process speech well. The temporal lobe also consolidates short-term memory into long-term memory. So you teach a new concept in math, you review it every day for a while after you teach it, and then you go on to other things. Time for the test, you come back and review that concept. If it transferred into the long-term memory, the child remembers 2-3 months later when you come back to review that concept. So temporal lobe is also consolidates the short-term memory into long-term memory. Frontal lobe is the most important area for defining who we are. That's our personality. So if you hear stories of people who had brain damage and their personality changes, it's very likely damage to the frontal lobe. The frontal lobe is responsible for complex mental processes such as thinking, planning, decision-making, social behavior, language, voluntary movement. I'm really curious how many of us use our frontal lobe as soon as the alarm rings in the morning. We start thinking, can I hit the snooze? Can I still get to school in time? Cerebellum is located at the back of our head, and this is the coordinating center for movement. Allows our muscles to work in coordination, and it's important for voluntary movement and balance. Now, I know that was pretty fast, but let's just review a little bit. Give me in a few words, what is the lower part of the brain responsible for? Call it out.
Survival.
Survival, very good. Survival function. Call out some of the things that the upper part of the brain is responsible for.
Interpersonal relationships.
Good. Relationships.
Processing.
Processing.
Memory.
Personality.
Yes.
Seeing and hearing.
Mm-hmm. Reasoning. Decision making. And which part is fully developed at birth?
Lower.
And then the upper is the one that develops throughout our lives. So when you see your trauma child, remember they may not be thinking further than 15 seconds into their future, because they are thinking survival. We're going to go over the 5 stages of brain development. Neurogenesis happens before birth. And this is the initial stage where the body makes nerve cells called neurons. These are produced at the rate of 250,000 every minute, and they form as fast as falling raindrops in a driving rainstorm before the baby's born. So a baby has 1 billion brain cells by the time of birth. Cell migration is where the neurons travel to their proper locations. They grow dendrites and axons, messengers that take information to and from each neuron. Cell differentiation is where an immature cell becomes specialized, reaching its mature form and function. And synaptogenesis is where the neurons start talking to each other. The axon of one neuron connects with a dendrite of another neuron, and this is what we call a synapse. So it's an electrical impulse that creates the release of neurotransmitters. We could call it a chemical conversation of information, but simply stated, this is how the brain transfers information from one part to the other. So that's synaptogenesis, where the brain is transferring information. And this extremely fast and efficient process is important for everything the brain does, including learning, memorizing, and coordinated movement. So if your brain can do this, if it can transfer information quickly, it makes it easier to be able to learn and play with coordination. Do you notice how learning and coordination sometimes go hand in hand? Poor coordination, poor learning, not always, but sometimes students can struggle with both. And complex neural networks. As our brains transfer information throughout them over and over again, this forms pathways in the brain. And that simply means densely connected brain cells. And these are the pathways that govern almost everything we do, from our most complicated thoughts and feelings to our survival functions. So how sturdy and stable we are depends upon how fully developed these networks are within our brain. Myelination is a fatty substance called myelin. Coats the axon like a wetsuit, protecting it and speeding up connections. Speedy connections, good learning. The healthy fats in a mother's milk construct myelin more easily than the fats found in formula. So if a child was formula fed, they may need more healthy fats in their diet. And this is also why some children with learning problems benefit from taking fish oil supplements. Healthy fats and fish oils. Any comments so far? Comments or questions? I feel like I kind of ran down over the information, but I wanted to at least give a... We are, yes.
How old is the child when the cell migration normally starts? I don't know when they're going to find their place in the brain.
I am not sure. Yeah. That's a good question, though.
Because I'm wondering if that is why the child I work with struggles. Because he was had trauma at such an early age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the neurogenesis is what happens before birth, and then these other things are what would happen after. Yeah, I find it fascinating. I think that a little bit of a knowledge of the brain and how it works can help to understand the behavior of our students. That doesn't make any sense to us. Effects of trauma on a child's brain development. So one of my friends planned to take care of this little girl, she's a Waterhead baby, until the little girl could be adopted. And she wanted to go see her in the hospital, and she wondered if I wanted to go along. And I was teaching at the time, she was going on a Saturday, and I love new experiences. I said, sure, I'll go along. So we bused to San Pedro and went to see this little girl in the hospital. We were with a couple who was involved in the foster to adopt system down there in Honduras. And after the hospital, they took us to a government children's home. And as we headed into the orphanage, they told us we could pick up the children, interact with them, take them out of their cribs, change their diapers. And unfortunately, I don't have any pictures of the orphanage that day. But that's pretty much what it looked like. It's a little different to see it in real life than to see it on pictures. So cribs lining the wall and down through the center, two rooms full of cribs, two workers to take care of two dozen children, some of them special needs, some of them babies. And the couple we were with said that the babies get their bottles propped up on pillows. So if they don't drink them, they don't get fed. I thoroughly enjoyed interacting with the children. But one thing haunted me long after the visit was over, and that was their eyes. No life in their eyes. I can still see those eyes. So what happens to the brain cells of children like these from an orphanage? So we have survival functions. The downstairs part of the brain is fully active at birth, which is responsible for the survival functions. We often hear fight, flight, or freeze. So these children have that. The upstairs brain is responsible for complex thought, reasoning, emotional processing, memory, speech, the ability to regulate our behavior. And remember, this is a part that develops throughout our lives. So what stimulates healthy brain development? If we're not born with these connections, how do we get them? Relationships. Care, nurture, and love allow a small child's brain to develop optimally. They become convinced that they are precious and they live out of that belief system. Positive experiences. Through repeated positive experiences, a child develops the connections needed to access the upper areas of the brain. So all those normal experiences in a loving family, think about how you take a little child, you play with them, you bounce them on your knees, you play pat-a-cake, you throw them up in the air over your head and catch them again. All those things are great for optimal brain development. And so many of these things in a loving family happen without us thinking about it. And then also movement. As a baby moves through the normal stages of development, connections form in the brain. So a baby lying on his tummy and kicking his arms and legs, reaching for objects and putting them in their mouth, learning to crawl, all these things are helping a baby's brain to develop. How many of you are familiar with the book Childhood Development by Joan Martin? That's a great resource for explaining how movement helps a child to develop. I really enjoy that book. It's a very easy read, I would say. So think about the children, back to the children in the orphanage. How many of these three things are they getting? Are they getting relationship? Are they getting positive experiences? Movement? Almost nothing. So trauma stunts brain development. The child gets stuck in the lower part of the brain in survival mode, but this is exactly why the child does survive. If they did not have this survival setting in their brain, they wouldn't survive in such desperate circumstances. As we talk about trauma, remember that the brain is plastic. This means that the brain is a living, growing organism with an enormous capacity for change. And this is where being fearfully and wonderfully made comes in. Our brains can change. There is hope. So just as trauma can harm brain development, the opposite is also true. The plasticity of the brain allows for healing to take place. So there is hope for children of all ages. It's not a certain age, and then there's no hope for you. No, there's hope for everybody. So back to the effects of trauma on the child's brain. With every interaction and experience, our brain makes connections. So if your early experiences were positive, the child grows and thrives. They feel loved, wanted, and secure. If a child's early experiences were traumatic, these experiences harm the structure of the brain, putting the child at risk for a lifetime of social, behavioral, and academic issues. So we're going to go through several effects of trauma on the brain. This is more looking at how it affects the child's brain. So the brainstem reorganizes around harm. So the bottom part of the brain actually overdevelops from reacting to fear. And the lower part of the brain, based on one word, would be, if you would give one word, what would you say? I shouldn't limit it to one word that everybody's scared to say. What's the bottom part of the brain more or less responsible for?
Survival,
yeah, that's the word. Very good. And so this part of the brain is constantly watching to keep the child alive. Fear. They're fearful. Their amygdala is working overtime. So can you imagine being scared right now that the person beside you in this class might hurt you? Can you imagine if you were constantly feeling like you needed to scan everybody and make sure nobody is going to hurt you? Just how much do you think you would learn from class if you were fearful? This type of child is a little paranoid. They're constantly scanning the environment, appraising the situation, trying to figure out if they can relax, trying to read faces, trying to figure out how they can get what they need, how they can get what they want. And if they feel too scared, I've got to get out of here. So they don't think through what they do when a crisis comes. They react. If they feel threatened or overwhelmed, the brain kicks into survival mode and it's fight, flight, or freeze. So there was a little girl down in Honduras. She was in the first grade classroom, but I worked with her just a little bit. And I got in on all three of her survival reactions, fight, flight, and freeze. So one day, her family dropped her off at school and she refused to go to the first grade classroom. I don't remember how she landed up in my classroom. Maybe because I was the one that didn't have devotions and all the students in my room to start the day. And that day she was in the flight mode. So I just let her know that when she's ready, she can go to the first grade classroom. But until then, she needs to stay in my room. Then I went on with my classes. My students came over, I had classes. However, I caught her doing this ever so slowly. She was inching towards the door, very slowly. I was like, she's gonna make a run for it if she gets a chance. So my chair was in front of the classroom door, close to it, so I just sat on my chair and taught classes from there. Block the escape route. Anyway, so when I had a break in my schedule and she was the only one in my room, I tried holding her and that flipped the fight switch. And she kicked and moaned and I sang softly until she got tired. One time we did that, I was pretty tired till we were done as well. Anyway, she finally gave in. I don't remember how long the fight lasted. She finally gave in, calmed down, and she was ready to go to her classroom. Another time I was working with her on math practice. And she was becoming easily distracted, and my classroom door faced the outside. So anybody going by outside, playing outside, was a distraction, so I simply got up and shut the door. Almost as soon as I shut the door, she went into freeze. She just slouched in her chair, head went down. She sat so still, I could not get any reaction out of her. So that time, I did the same thing, told her clearly what she needs to do when she's ready. She should let me know. She stayed like that for a long time. It was close to the end of the day. I think we made it to the end of the day. My students left. I pulled her on my lap and I held her. She did not give in until I tipped her back and made eye contact with her. I was about at the end. I hadn't even thought of the eye contact thing, and one of my co-teachers was right outside the door, and she said, make eye contact. And that's what broke her. That, to me, was a powerful lesson of how well eye contact can help. So if the brain stays in this survival mode too long, it reorganizes around survival at the expense of healthy development of other parts of the brain. So while they're busy surviving, the front part of their brain doesn't get any practice. They're not using it. Thinking, planning, reasoning doesn't get any practice. They're too busy trying to figure out how they can get what they need, how they can get what they want, and even how they can get their own way. When another child falls flat on their face, a child who is living in survival mode laughs. He can understand how funny it looked, but understanding how the person feels is a function of the upper part of the brain, and they don't understand that. This also made a lot of sense to me. I was in a youth group with pretty many trauma youth, and I used to get annoyed because as soon as anybody tripped or messed up, they would just laugh. I'm like, don't do that. When I realized this, I was like, you know what? It's part of that. It's something that needs overcome, but they can understand how silly it looks, but not the emotions. The stress system changes. We talked a little bit about cortisol, the stress hormone. And our bodies are made to release higher amounts during stress. So right now, my body is probably releasing more cortisol than normal, having to be in this position and speaking. And that's a good thing. It gives you what you need to get through a stressful time. However, if cortisol stays too high for too long, that's when it starts to create damage and becomes toxic. And the prefrontal cortex is most vulnerable. That's the part that can be severely affected from chaos in a child's life. And the prefrontal cortex is a part of the brain that controls memory, emotion, and attention. It actually controls almost everything our body does. Impulsivity, anxiety, aggression. When to start and stop something. Do you ever run into that one? Do you ever have children who get upset if you ask them to stop one thing and start another? It can be a very simple change. I've had that. Being able to control our own behavior. The prefrontal cortex is so important for everything we do. So if we have too much cortisol for too long, communication becomes impaired. And the dendrites in some parts of the brain shrink. I would like ideas from you. Like, how do these things look in our school students? Especially thinking about too much cortisol, brainstem reorganizing around harm. Can we just have a few things from the class as far as things you've maybe noticed in children or things that, behaviors that would possibly be because of this lower part of the brain overdeveloping? Inability to focus. And that's when we run into a lot in the classroom.
Lack of empathy.
Lack of empathy, yes. Yeah, that's a very real one. They don't have the ability to just let things go. They absorb. Very good. Thank you for that. I had to think of memory is affected. We talked about not being able to stay focused, emotionally unstable. That came up as well. Unreasonable fears. Yes, those are all things that they deal with. What are natural changes in cortisol throughout the day? So just before we wake up in the morning, the cortisol shoots up. It's basically a natural caffeine for the body. And then during the day, it slowly starts to come back down. Until night, it's so low that we can go to sleep. And then during the night, it slowly rises again. That's a natural cycle. For a child who has been harmed, the cycle has been disrupted. cortisol stays way too high. And when cortisol stays too high, it numbs you to pain. Some children have superhuman abilities to accept pain because the high cortisol numbs them. High levels are associated with younger children internalizing. They become withdrawn and anxious. And some, their cortisol has been so high for so long that they have burned out. And when they burn out, they usually have externalizing behavior. They come out fighting. Disruption in ability to sleep, to calm down, and to self-regulate. Trauma also affects neurochemical production. And the neurotransmitters are the chemical messengers the brain sends the body. Some excite and some calm. So there's two types of neurotransmitters, excitatory neurotransmitters and inhibitory neurotransmitters. So the excitatory neurotransmitters give me energy. They help me think. They give me what I need to get through the day. And the inhibitory neurotransmitters calm me down and help me to sleep at night. So we need a balance. We need both. Being hungry, cold, and scared, and not having your needs met produces too many excitatory neurotransmitters. If these are not balanced by inhibitory neurotransmitters, they promote action. A child becomes reactive. If something happens, I'm going to react. The inhibitory neurotransmitters are produced by positive relationships. When a caregiver comes, takes care of the child, gives food, gives warmth, safety, the inhibitory neurotransmitters balance out the excitatory ones. And this is what we need for healthy brain chemistry. Inhibitory neurotransmitters also come from nutrient-rich foods. Other disruptions in neurochemical production would be fetal alcohol syndrome. And the fetal alcohol syndrome is like pouring Clorox on the brain. So glutamate fries the brain when you have too much. Children can have numbers up to 200 or 300 when they should be at 10. These are the children that get labeled willful and belligerent in the schools because he looks perfectly normal, but his brain was changed from the alcohol exposure. So they appear brilliant, but there's this learning disorder in a certain area, and it's a puzzle. Effects of trauma on a child's brain, one brain hemisphere is more active than the other. So we want both hemispheres to be working together. The two sides coordinate logic and emotion. The left side of the brain is responsible for logic. A left-brainer can learn with black and white. They do well with math. They're analytical. The right side of the brain controls our emotions and sees the big picture. A right-brainer loves creativity, color, learns well with pictures. Now, we tend towards one side or the other. Are you a left-brainer or a right-brainer? How many are left-brainers? You would tend towards that side. How many are right-brainers? You love creativity, pictures, color. And it's great. Definitely gives us our different gifts and talents. When children are in situations where their needs are not responded to emotionally and they are not taken care of, often one side or the other will take over. So if the right hemisphere does not get developed, the child is cut off from their emotions. When the left side does not get developed, a child is flooded by their emotions. I'd like to break into groups again, probably more like 3, 4, 5, something like that. And I would like you to write down examples of how this child looks in the classroom and in real life. We had some discussion throughout the class, a little bit here and there, but I would like you to write these down and I would like you to hand them in, if you don't mind. I would like to see them before class tomorrow. We're going to be getting a lot more practical ideas of how to work with the children tomorrow. So, feel free to share with each other. We have about 5 minutes here. Take time to tell some stories, write some things down on your paper. I think I have a sheet in your handout that you should be able to just tear out. Okay, go ahead. We'll go about 5 minutes here. Okay, time's up. Almost time to dismiss here. I would say when you walk by here, maybe just drop your papers here on the corner of the table. And I'll share a few that I wrote down. Children from hard places can be developmentally half their age. That really helped me because I can be a very cut and dried person and it's like, you're 12, duh. It's not going to help them. And so I had to learn to look at them for where they're at, not for the age that they have. The age that they have developmentally and not the age that their birthday says they are. Another one is the emotional roller coaster. Life is wonderful. They're all happy. They're singing at the top of their lungs, and the next minute, they're yelling insults. It's another one that I've dealt with, been around. Receiving a no feels like a personal insult. They hate to be told no, even if it's about something simple. Fear of failure so much that they refuse to play a game because they're scared they're going to look dumb or they won't win. And they just sometimes look crazy. Their actions don't make any sense to somebody who can use the front part of their brains. So I'm looking forward to reading what you have after class. I want to end with this slide. Although the world is full of suffering, it is also full of the overcoming of it. And tomorrow we're going to talk a lot about the overcoming. You're dismissed. Thank you so much for your participation. I really enjoyed it.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.